Good morning. This is hour number two, Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frank, he's at the controls. We're here weekday mornings 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week. If you'd like to look at the schedule so you can know about programs that are coming up, listen to some that you might have missed, sign up for the podcast, and just generally get information on programming that we do on WILL Radio and TV, go to our website. That is willill.illinois.edu, and it will tell you everything you need to know. We're pleased here to have back with us once again on the program Mae Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects, and many times here over the years, she's been good enough to come over here and to talk about insects. I always say, now when she's here now, save your extermination questions because that's not her specialty. We have a guy for that who specializes in insect control, Phil Nixon, who's been here fairly recently, and I'm sure that he'll be here again in, later on in the summer, that can help with insect pests if you're trying to get rid of them. And sometimes, yeah, you got to do that. But when Mae is here, we do something a little bit different. And from the very first time she was ever here, which goes back, I don't know how many years, we said
1982.
In 1982, she's got that. It's burned, it's seared into her consciousness. 1982. We've just said, well, bugs are cool. Insects are cool. And let's talk about them and try to appreciate them for the great variety. And if there is some insect that you have seen, if you call in, give us the best description that you can, Mae will try and tell you what it is. And I've seen her do that many times here. It's sometimes a little difficult because, you know, if you could show her a picture, that'd be one thing. But trying to describe it, now that's something else. But you can do that. And any and all questions that have to do with insects, give us a call.
I always remember the ones that got away.
She always feels very bad. She's afraid that people are going to, everybody's going to call in and ask something that she's going to say, golly, I'm sorry, I don't know. But that hasn't happened.
I remember the old-fashioned potato beetle. I didn't recognize. I should have. The description was great, and I just missed that one. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're not keeping score. She's keeping score. 333-9455, that's for Champaign Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have someone here ready to go already, so we'll talk with him in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Okay, is that my turn?
Yes.
My question is about bees. I've been hearing a lot of news about the bees are dying and they're leaving the hives and they don't come back. And I'm wondering if... because of all the bean crops and the corn crops that are heavily sprayed with insecticides and pesticides, if that's just common sense that that's what's killing them. And so would you talk about that?
Oh, actually, I'd be delighted. It's hard to get me to stop talking about that because we're kind of involved here. It's what's called colony collapse disorder, this mysterious phenomenon that was first noted around October 2006 that beehives, colonies were falling apart in a very distinctive way.
Falling apart?
Honeybee colonies,
oh,
you know,
colonies.
The nest boxes. And usually there's 30,000 to 50,000 workers in one such a box, the type that beekeepers maintain. But inexplicably, what was happening is that all the oldest, most experienced bees, the foragers, were simply disappearing. What happens when a bee becomes an adult, starts out life as a grub, and then it molts into adulthood, and the worker bees go through a series of tasks. So the youngest bees, the most inexperienced bees, do hive cleanup and sort of mundane chores, and then they move on to be nurse bees and take care of the grubs. And the very oldest and presumably wisest bees are the ones that leave the hive, find nectar and pollen, and bring those back to the hive and communicate to the other bees as to where the good sources are. Well, in this peculiar phenomenon, it was the foragers that were disappearing. And one argument against insecticides is that, I mean, bees have been killed by insecticides since we started spraying insecticides, and they're extremely vulnerable to pesticides. It turns out compared to other insects, they don't have many enzymes that break down pesticides. The yellow fever mosquito, for example, has about 160 different genes that code for enzymes that metabolize pesticides and other related toxins. And honeybees have 46, so they're just not well equipped. But typically, they will die. There'll be stacks and stacks of dead bees in front of the hive.
Will they get back to the hive somehow?
Right. That's typically what happens with pesticide poisoning. But these were just disappearing. Now, it happens that there is a new type of insecticide, a class of insecticides called the neonicotinoids, that arguably could be changing the way bees respond in that at very low doses, these are not lethal, but they're called sublethal. They don't kill them outright, but basically they cause brain damage. And there's a lot of evidence from laboratory studies that that exposure to low levels of imidacloprid in particular, one of the neonicotinoids, will cause bees to have shorter memories and get easily confused. So that could explain the absence of returning foragers. The problem with that hypothesis, and actually it's a very appealing hypothesis because these neonicotinoids are used everywhere now. And it's the most widely selling insecticide class in the world today and all kinds of crops. So ostensibly there's the possibility of exposure. The problem is, two problems, is there's just been a series of studies conducted on insecticide residues in the hive itself, and where you would expect to see accumulation of whatever toxic material is responsible. And there are plenty of chemical contaminants in the hive, but there's very little evidence that any neonicotinoids are there. So there's no smoking gun here. Another problem is, you know, those I mentioned those 46 genes that code for enzymes that break down pesticides. Usually when an insect is challenged with an insecticide, the protein that breaks it down gets production of that protein gets cranked up, and you can see that in the genome. You can visualize the response of the organism to the environmental challenge by various and sundry molecular techniques, notably microarray. Well, we've been doing some of those techniques because this is actually University of Illinois, the home of the Honeybee Genome Project, at least the annotation, the sort of recording what genes do what. And there's no signal there. So there have been lots of people trying to link the phenomenon to insecticides, but it doesn't work. And the other problem, too, is that with insecticide exposure, again, these chemicals have been out for 10 years. So why in 2006 does it start happening, and why does it spread across the country? This would argue for a pathogenic disease. And bees are incredibly susceptible to diseases and epidemics because, just like us, they live in cities. You know, there's 30 to 50,000 of them crowded into one building, basically. They're in close proximity to each other. And it turns out they don't have very many immunity genes either. And in fact, a study that was published last year showed evidence there is what was thought to be a new disease in North America called Israeli acute paralysis virus was detected for the first time, and it was showed up in 96% of the colonies that were sick instead of healthy. So even the investigators didn't say that's the cause, because what Israeli acute paralysis virus is called Israeli acute paralysis virus because it was discovered in Israel a few years ago, and the symptoms of IAPV are not what colony collapse disorder is. Kind of makes the bees sort of shiver and then collapse in a heap in the front of the hive. So, and then it turned out the USDA had frozen bees from 2002 and, well, I guess 2004, so before we had CCD here, and found evidence that virus has been here for several years doing nothing in particular. So it's hard to argue that it's this new virus. So the long story, to make a long story short, it's still a mystery, and it's still killing bees. The Apiary Inspectors of America just conducted a survey of losses from 2007 to 2008, and they're up. They're increasing. So this year, 36% of America's bees went missing or 37%? Dying.
37%?
Yeah, 36%, yeah. And the majority of those deaths were attributable to this mysterious phenomenon called colony collapse disorder. So it is approaching crisis proportions because honeybees are really the only practical managed pollinator we have. And every spring, you know, America has about 2.4 million bees. Every spring, about 1.2 million bees get trucked to California to pollinate almonds.
Mm-hmm.
And the almond growers are expanding their acreage, and they have nothing to pollinate them with. And here we are, incredibly sophisticated technological society. We can put a spacecraft on Mars, but we can't put pollen on an almond flower in an orchard without honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a serious problem. And amazingly enough, Congress paid attention. And for the first time in the history of U.S. agriculture, the U.S. Farm Bill has language about pollinator protection. It's not bad for a $15 billion industry. I guess bees don't have, or pollinators don't have particularly effective lobby, I guess, compared to some of the others. But finally, let's hope it's not, what is the expression, after the closing the barn door after the horse is gone,
mm-hmm.
or after the horsefly is gone, I guess would be more appropriate. Just last week, I told you it was dangerous to ask me about this. How long is the show? An hour? Last week was National Pollinator Awareness Week, and our department was actively involved, actually all the entomologists in town, because it's amazing for the birds and the bees are supposed to be so easy that even a child, you know, could understand the basics. But if you grabbed anyone off the street and asked them to, like, diagram floral anatomy, you know, nobody would know they wouldn't be able to answer, right? They wouldn't be able to give you the answer.
They don't know their pistil from their stamen?
That's exactly right.
Very
it's an incredibly intriguing problem, but it's also very worrisome.
So just if you quit pesticides and insecticides on the beans and the corn, that isn't going to make any difference to the bees disappearing?
Most likely not. You know, one reason I say that with some certainty is that, first of all, bees don't eat corn pollen. Corn is a wind-pollinated plant, which is why...
doesn't all this stuff go, all this poison roam around in the air?
They're more likely to... encounter pollen of plants that are insect pollinated, and corn is wind pollinated. But the reason I think that it's unlikely to be pesticides or genetically modified crops, which a lot of people have argued that it might be, is here in Illinois, where in Champaign County anyway, 80% of our, probably 90%+ is corn and soybeans, and 80% of that is genetically modified. We don't have a single case of colony collapse disorder here.
Don't have a single case of what?
Colony collapse disorder, even in Illinois, that's been confirmed. So neighboring states are suffering, but we are the corn and bean capital of the U.S., and we're safe from so far. We haven't had to deal with colony collapse disorder. So any explanation would have to account for that peculiar epidemiological pattern. So I think we can, at least on this basis, it's not likely to be what they're spraying on corn and beans, because otherwise Illinois bees would be in a sorry state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. I'm glad to learn all that.
Yeah, I'm sure that's more than you bargained for, but as you can see, I'm very interested in this.
Well, this is it's very important,
yeah.
And we started talking about this when this was new, and probably every time you've been here since then, I've said, well, you know, what's up
with
that?
What's up with the bees?
With
the
bees, and what do we know? And it's something that's actually gotten a fair amount of attention in the popular media, so people have been reading about the stories.
Well, have you seen The Happening, the M. Night Shyamalan
No, I haven't. I guess I've read some.
There's a colony reviews. Collapse disorder reference in the
really?
In Mark Wahlberg plays a high school science teacher in Philadelphia, and the opening scene of the movie, and it's featured in the preview, is him asking his class, class, the bees are mysteriously disappearing. Anybody have any hypotheses? What, don't you care about the bees? Which is like, why would you expect a high school kid to know what the answer is? Or care particularly about the bees. So, but I was astonished to see that, because this has to be the fastest that an entomological phenomenon has shown up in a movie. You know, lots of entomological phenomena, killer bees, but it took about 7 years for killer bees to show up in movies after they sort of started making headlines on their own. So that has to set a cultural land speed record or something.
May Barenbaum is with us. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects, and every once in a while she's here, and that's what we do. I encourage people to call in and talk about insects, appreciate them for all of the cool stuff that they do. And if you have something that you've seen and you're curious about it, if you can give us a good description, May will see if she can tell you what it is. Otherwise, other sorts of questions are insect-related questions, certainly welcome, except extermination ones. So save those for another time. Belgium, the next caller here, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Two items. First one, to continue on with your first question with the first caller. You said there are no colony collapses in Illinois.
Confirmed.
Confirmed,
yeah.
Yes. But you'll be hard-pressed to find a feral colony in the woods anyplace. It's
very true.
Very difficult to find.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a feral colony in most states, actually.
That's right. So maybe there are colony collapses that we just don't have in the same way. And I've noticed that my favorite cherry tree and my peach trees don't seem to have near as much fruit on them anymore.
That's a recurring problem. There have been a number of scientific studies published recently of what's called pollen limitation, which means that plants are not reproducing at maximum capacity because they're not receiving enough pollen. There are lots of reasons they might not be, and that's hard to tell retrospectively, but one of the prime reasons for pollen limitation is pollinator limitation. And, there's a lot of concern not just about honeybees, which are managed pollinators, but about our native wild pollinators, too. Because, bumblebees are disappearing. There's at least two species that used to be quite common in Illinois that nobody has seen for years. And two in the West, in the West Coast, that may also either be seriously endangered or extinct by now.
Well, and then to get on to the actual question we're going to get into, which is another item, which maybe people aren't too concerned about, but I am. This is the time of the year that you start running across a very reclusive little spider. I know it's not an insect, but the recluse spider can give you an awful nasty bite. And I thought it might be informative to everybody who listens to have a nice description of them and what it looks like and where you might find them and stuff like that. Because I go poking around in a lot of places, and you know, those bites are nasty.
They are, although it's happens that, well, the characteristic of a brown recluse bite, there are only two species of spiders in North America that can actually cause death. One is the black widow, which has what's called a neurotoxic venom. It's a venom that acts on the nervous system and makes basically respiratory paralysis sets in and you stop breathing and die. The other is the brown recluse, Loxosceles reclusa, which has a different kind of venom. It's a necrotizing venom, and what it does, it pumps in venoms that just basically dissolve your tissues, and what results is sort of a deep and potentially gangrenous ulcerating wound. Brown recluse blight bites can lead to amputations and septicemia and death. They are called recluses because, as you say, they are not when you're sort of hail fellow well met spiders that are in your face all the time. They're shy. They like to hang out in undisturbed areas, but frankly, we humans are so busy and in so many different places that we are running into them far more often than we used to, and that's part of the problem. And they're sometimes called the fiddleback spider because they have, fortunately, a very distinctive marking. It's shaped like a violin, so they're brown, and then a darker brown or black violin-shaped marking is kind of a dead giveaway. But the problem, I shouldn't probably say dead giveaway, should I?
No.
The problem with that is that's true for the adult stages, but not for all immature stages. And the males, actually, the markings aren't quite as conspicuous. Same thing goes, the black widow is supposed to be unmistakable for its red bright red hourglass on a black shiny body, but the immatures are all brown. So it's tricky. Ooh, after when you get a bite, it can range from just sort of swelling and irritation to, you know, ultimately the blistering, oozing, pustulous wound that ultimately can become necrotic and cause chills and fever and nausea and in some cases, but not that often, it can cause death. The controversial thing is a lot of people come to emergency rooms or to their doctor's office with these ulcerating wounds, and they blame brown recluses, and the doctors record these as brown recluse bites. But rarely do people bring the spiders in, and there are at least a dozen other sorts of injuries or even diseases that can cause that kind of ulcerating wound. If you go to University of California Riverside, has two entomologists who are kind of on a crusade to, clear the air, to reclaim the reputation of the brown recluse. A lot of bites are attributed to brown recluse well outside the range that any arachnologist has ever collected one, including in Southern California, which is where University of California Riverside is. So if you are bitten by a spider, it's really, really important to try to track down the perpetrator, because that's the only way to confirm if it's a brown recluse bite.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time climbing through wood piles and stuff like
that. That's where you'll run into them.
When I say wood piles, I'm talking about lumber. But you find them down in through it, and I always try to wear gloves and a long shirt and stuff like that just to be a little bit more careful.
Absolutely. It's always good, because there's other things in hiding in wood that can be bad news too. That's a good precaution to take. This is actually within the range of brown recluses.
Yes, it is.
And, whether it's due to global warming or other factors, the distribution seems to be shifting northwards. So there are places where they're expanding their range. There was an interesting lawsuit in Indiana, I think it was 2 years ago, of a home that I guess had been vacant for a while that was absolutely infested with brown recluses and uninhabitable. And it was interesting because, for one thing, it was actually an example of bringing in experts who, confirmed the identification as brown recluse. But the other interesting thing is that the insurance company refused to pay damages, because they argued that they offered protection against insects, and recluses are not insects or spiders, which is
that's weasel stuff.
And, well, as it turns out, they lost that because historically spiders are considered insects legally, even if they're not. It's like the tomato is technically a fruit, but it's considered a vegetable by law. So the law doesn't always follow entomological or arthropodological lines. In general, if you find a light brown spider, it's, about a not that big. There may be like a half an inch long. They have very long legs, and there's a violin. Don't fiddle around, right? They are a real presence here, but I think the threat they present to people other than those who poke around wood piles has been kind of exaggerated.
Thank you very much.
All right,
thanks for the question.
If you're curious, and again, you have internet access, I've been here looking at there's lots of sites that have pictures. I'm totally creeped out now. I'm going to have nightmares now about brown recluse spiders, but there are plenty of examples. But it seems like a lot of these pictures, the mark that you talked about,
it's not a real clear violin.
It's not real clear violin, or just it looks like a brown
spot.
And it's so I think it might be sometimes might be difficult to determine that that's in fact what it is.
Yeah, for example, if it looks like a cello or a viola, you should still stay away from it.
Okay. And maybe some other spiders that are going to get into trouble because they just may have a passing resemblance to brown recluse, and someone's going to step on them because of that.
That's a risk too. But the main concern, and particularly in emergency rooms and filing insurance claims, is you don't really know it's a spider bite unless there's a spider.
Well, and also in one of these sites, there was some photographs of the wound from a recluse bite, and it's really nasty looking. But then right next to it, they showed a picture of something that was a result of a bacterial infection, and they look fairly similar. So not only could it be some other insect, it could be not an insect
at all.
So I guess the thing is, yeah, if you're sure that's what it is, you can convey that information, or if it's at all possible to, you know, recover the spider. But maybe after you've been bitten by it, you don't want to have any, either you want to squash it or you don't want to have anything to do with it.
And by the way, just for the record, there's absolutely no truth to this internet rumor that on average people swallow 8 to 10 spiders while they sleep over the course of their lives. I have no idea where that number came from, but there's like, everyone thinks it, and I get asked that a lot. So,
right.
So one of those flashing lights is that question you can
Okay. We have several callers here. We'll try to get everybody in and as many as we can. Mae Barenbaum is here. She's an entomologist. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I, and we're talking about insects. You got questions, give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up, Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Actually, I'm calling about the recluse. About a week and a half ago, I was bitten by one, and I went to the doctor, and it's being taken care of. But I work outside all day, so I assumed it was outside. But I went online and looked, and they said that the wolf spider is often mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, recently, within the last month and a half, we've caught two what we thought were wolf spiders in our house. They're out in the open, so we thought maybe the behavior didn't match, but... What do you think?
Oh, do you think you were bitten by a wolf spider instead of a recluse?
I'm wondering if those are recluse in my house.
Oh, wolf spiders look kind of different. I mean, they have you looked online at pictures? They're kind of sort of more heavy-bodied, and wolf spiders are runners, and they kind of look like runners.
It was a wolf spider then.
Okay, because recluses aren't really runners. They do make sort of a messy, irregular web, and they have these long, delicate kinds of legs.
Okay.
So if it's not particularly leggy, and it looks sort of stockier,
we found in our house we're running.
Yeah, my guess is if it's running, it's probably a wolf spider and not a recluse. And they also, was it like stripy sort of pattern or?
Yes.
Yeah, that's probably a wolf spider.
Our first thought was wolf spider. We caught them both and released them outside. And
oh, that's nice.
Had them in front of us.
Was that after you were bitten? You were that nice to spiders?
Well, I didn't know I was bitten until 2 days ago. Seeing the symptoms. I mean, I have this thing on my leg.
Oof, yeah.
The previous caller, I have a whole bunch more questions. If it's not a recluse, you said often it might be a different spider, but would you be prescribed the same meds? I mean, antibiotics.
Oh, absolutely, because that ugly goo is not always necessarily the product of the venom. It is the result of secondary infection. Okay. You know, puncture wounds leave skin vulnerable to colonizing microbes. And just as Ava was saying, particularly for people that have sort of compromised immune system, diabetics, for example, wounds can get... necrotic very easily, and then so once it's necrotic, it looks like every other kind of necrotic tissue. So, yeah, absolutely. Anybody, I'm not a physician. Not only am I not an insect toxicologist, I'm not a physician. But if I were bitten, that's what I would want. So
okay, and I've seen those pictures online, David, and I saw them after I went to the doctor, and it freaked me out. So my leg does not look like that.
I'm glad. I would not want to have a wound like that. It's really, they look really, really nasty.
And they leave scars.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for saving those wolf spiders.
That's what a remarkable degree of compassion. We'll give that guy the Albert Schweitzer Award. I don't think that I would be that nice. Wolf spiders, they really creep me out because they can be very,
very big.
Very big. And they call them wolf spiders because they chase down their prey. So they do run. They're not so much like the spiders that make a web and just sit there and wait for something to come into the web. So they're much more. I think if you saw a spider and it was in your house and was just out in the middle of the floor, That's probably not a recluse, but it may well be a
recluse. Unless it was a recluse with a personality disorder or something.
Yeah, really, because that's not, you know, the idea is that, they don't want to be out in the open. They're going to be back in the corners and in the places where maybe you're not going to go poking around. All right. We've done a lot of talking about spiders here. And I'm creeped out. Let's go to another caller. Champagne, this is line one. Hello.
Enough already.
Really? I'm with you. Yeah.
Give it a rest.
All right. We'll try not to say anything more.
My question is, yes. All right. Everybody calm down here. I'm calm and gentle here. Okay. My question is about lightning bugs.
All right. Okay.
Yes.
Am I mistaken? I don't seem to see the number of lightning bugs around these days, as I recall from my youth. And is it too early in the year for them yet, or what?
No, actually, many people have made that anecdotal observation.
Tell us about lightning bugs. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
So lightning bugs, of course, also called fireflies, they're actually beetles in the family Lampyridae, and they have this remarkable ability to generate cold light. In other words, they can make light with a chemical reaction that doesn't actually, you know, if you were holding an electric light in your hand for all night, it would, you know, because electricity is a very inefficient way to make light, but lightning bugs make it chemically very efficient. They flash these signals to each other under cover of night so they can see each other. They're species-specific flashings. It's one of the most remarkable biological phenomena here in the, you know, temperate zone. And unfortunately, no one's really been monitoring them formally, so if we don't have a baseline, it's hard to say that there are fewer, but there are a number of people around the country who are concerned. And one reason for concern is that there are biochemical supply companies that have basically put a bounty on lightning bugs. And the reason for that is that they use chemicals to make light. One of them is an enzyme called luciferase, and the other is a so-called substrate. That's what an enzyme works on. Called luciferin, and when luciferase when luciferin is present in the at the same time there is cellular living cells. Cells are fueled by a substance called ATP. In the presence of oxygen, that's when the light is emitted. So chemical companies have found all kinds of applications using both luciferase sort of a signal for living cells or the light that's produced by luciferin and luciferase. So there are all kinds of biochemical tests for drug-resistant bacteria or contaminants. And although they can generate the enzyme using genetic engineering, they can clone the gene that codes for the enzyme, the luciferin they still get from the butt ends of fireflies. And I just read a news story this morning of in Tennessee, they're, you know, paying kids to collect fireflies by the thousands or tens of thousands. And this has been ongoing. This is the company Promega, and Sigma used to do it even when, 20 years ago. And this is an editorial opinion, I think it's kind of irresponsible of the biochemical companies to be wild harvesting like this. If they want a steady supply of luciferin, it's sort of their responsibility to figure out ways to, obtain that sustainably. This is not sustainable to pay kids all around the country for collecting these things indiscriminately and sort of reaping the bounty without being responsible. Unfortunately, it's hard to make the case that, you know, not many people believe that insects can go extinct. You know, when Ronald Reagan was governor of California, he, in one of his speeches, he basically said outright that he didn't think that insects could possibly go extinct. Of course, as a class, you know, there are a million species, but individual species are known to have gone extinct. So it's these are insects that are they don't have very high reproductive potential because they have very few enemies. They're distasteful. They taste bad. That's why they can fly around at night and be incredibly visible, is that most predators of insects can't eat them. They contain a a drug that's basically it's a steroid, not a drug, a defensive compound that's like a steroid, and it's a heart poison. And in fact, every year the vet colleges across the country get sick lizards because kids can easily catch fireflies and give them to the lizards. Because the fireflies, over their evolutionary history, haven't had to worry about being caught, except by humans. So they're not designed like mosquitoes that lead a very perilous life and have an incredibly high reproductive potential. And it's entirely possible that over-collecting can jeopardize populations. So, I mean, I'm editorializing here because there is no baseline. But your anecdotal observation has been made by many others.
Now, I know certainly in my backyard, I now have, and for a while have been seeing them. There have been times when, and I'm lucky I have a good dark backyard and there's a fair amount of foliage, when the number has been stunning, absolutely stunning. And this year, it's certainly not stunning, maybe not yet. There is a peak for when you should expect to see the greatest numbers. Are we around that point?
It's really hard to predict. I look for large numbers on the 4th of July around here, which I think is incredibly cool that they're out shooting off firefly works at the same time we're doing fireworks. But this has been such a bizarre spring and summer.
Yeah.
Things are late. Things are early. Things are not there. Things that are here that aren't usually here. So hard to predict whether we're approaching the peak or we've already peaked because there's so many variables.
Yeah, just this week I saw my first Japanese beetles.
Yeah, that's Phil Nixon's report said last week that, or the 20th, I think it was the first in the southern part of the state. So, yep, that's starting.
All right. Let's go on here to Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Japanese beetles. I wonder if there's something in a yellow rose that they don't like because the red rose is latticed and the are eaten away, and the other rose hasn't been dined on at all. So I don't know if there's anything that they can learn from you. Anyone could learn from that. But I had a couple of specifics and then a general thing. I don't know how long the NOVA program that you participated in was made, but I mean, is there any update you could give? How are we doing as far as reacting to the threat of mass extinction of our pollinators? And I noticed locally that the bee farm, as it's called colloquially, is being rebuilt. It's about time. It seemed like that was one of the shabbiest buildings on campus, off campus.
I'm surprised you even know of its existence.
Yeah, well, I had reasons to be there. It's a nice place to go wander around. I don't know if I should invite a lot of people to go.
Well, actually, we would like to. What we're doing is converting.
Well, that's the other question. I heard something about an outreach program
yep.
or some kind of building. And then I'll hang up and listen. But there was one more thing. A friend of mine is taking pictures of bees, and he says there are an awful lot of flies that the birds won't eat because they look
like
a little
bees.
Bit like bees.
Yep.
And how do we tell when... he said there's an amazing number, and it's selection, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It's, the birds were steering clear of anything that looked like a bee, I guess. So,
yeah, they are astonishing mimics. This is a phenomenon called, Batesian mimicry. It's named for a guy named Bates, not surprisingly, 19th century Amazonian explorer, who noticed in big clouds of butterflies that there are many species of butterflies that are toxic because they feed on poisonous plants, but there are others that have an uncanny resemblance to them that are studiously avoided by birds that have learned to avoid the poisonous ones. So it's mimicry, it's protective mimicry. The most famous example is the monarch butterfly, which stores heart poisons, cardiac glycosides, from its milkweed hosts that is mimicked throughout its range by the viceroy. In fact, that's what the name refers to. The viceroy is sort of second to the king, the monarch. And the monarch does not feed on milkweeds. It feeds on plants in the poplar family. And for a long time, it was assumed that it was totally palatable. But as it turns out, it's a little bit distasteful, too. But in the case of the bee mimics, the bees are well-equipped with stingers that have venom that's actually designed to be intensely painful and eminently memorable. And there's a whole suite of completely edible insects that benefit from a physical, behavioral, and even acoustical resemblance to bees. Some of the flies buzz at more or less the same frequency. And the most notorious family for this is the syrphid family, the hoverflies. And there are all kinds of hoverflies, including one that looks just like the honeybee, Ristilus tenax. And there's one. There's others that resemble bumblebees, and there's some that resemble solitary bees. The dead giveaway to distinguish a fly from a bee is that flies only have two wings. Bees have four. You have to look really carefully, but. That's why Diptera is the order to which flies belong, di meaning two and Ptera meaning wings. They try to fool you. There are some syrphids that have an extra dark line in the middle of their one pair of wings that makes it look like two wings. Another way to distinguish is that the flies that typically mimic bees have stubby little antennae, and bees have nice long antennae. But there are syrphid flies, or hover flies, flower flies they're called, that have black front, the front part of their front legs is colored black, and when they rest, they dangle their front legs in front of their heads so that they look like long antennae. So they're really keen to fool you. But and it's interesting. We have an outreach project called Bee Spotter, and I hope your friend hears about it. Just go Google Bee Spotter, and you'll find our site. We're trying to recruit citizen scientists to photograph bees, record their location so that we will have a documented record of sightings of species of bees identified to species, honeybees and bumblebees. And we'd like to compare those contemporary sightings to the historical record that we have from the collection of the Natural History Survey here, about 4,000 records for bumblebees and honeybees. And anyone can do it as long as you have a digital camera and access to a computer. And if you upload the trouble with you know, bird watchers have been doing this for years, but the way you identify birds is you look through your binoculars and look in a guidebook. The way that experts identify bees for the most part is by dissecting out their genitalia and looking at them under a microscope. And this is very hard to convince citizen scientists, particularly when the genitalia are like capable of delivering venom. So we've limited this then to the 11 bumblebees in Illinois and the honeybee, which can be distinguished based on their color. And the long story short, if you upload your image, it will be vetted by an expert. And the second photo, we opened the site up in October last year, the second photo uploaded to our site was a gorgeous, spectacular photo of a syrphid fly that had been identified as a honeybee by the bee spotter.
Okay, so this is something. And what about the bee house?
Oh, yes. We have a new, brand new bee research facility that is south on Lincoln, and we had a reduced use of our old bee lab, which is, as the caller suggested, was basically it used to be a pesticide storage shed, basically. But it was, you know, it was in 1989 was equipped to be a research quality facility. But since the research use has tapered off a bit, we thought it's perfect opportunity to create what we're calling a pollinatarium. Not a planetarium. Planetarium is planets. Pollinatarium celebrates pollinators of all sorts. And it will actually – it's being gutted and retrofitted. We'll have displays for all the major pollinator groups. We're hoping to have a shade house where, butterfly garden – butterfly voliaries or, you know, butterfly gardens you can walk through are fairly common. We'd like to have a place where you can walk through for the less charismatic pollinators like moths and some of those flower flies you can actually see. There are interactive displays and all kinds of other activities. And this is made largely possible by the incredible generosity of Peter Fox, who's one of the local developers, who through a series of connections felt that this project would be ideal for particularly for elementary school kids as a place to visit. So it's with his help we were making this conversion. Ultimately, the building will not look like a pesticide storage shed. It will look like a hive box with the bee frames visible. It's going to be just wonderful, and we're hoping that it'll be ready in September.
Great. Very good. So look forward to that. We have a couple minutes left here. We have some other callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Next person is in Crete on our line four. Hello.
Yeah, I looked down the other night in the crevice of the outside wall. There were dozens of little brown mites, the smallest insect I've ever seen, with the wings that fly to the light and to the white walls. What are they? And since I have a cat or two inside, how can I get rid of them inside as well as spraying outside?
Well, you say they're winged?
Yeah, winged midgets.
Because they're not mites if they're winged, because mites have no wings.
No, these fly up to the walls and the light, and they're very small and brown-bodied.
What kind of brown?
Just
a nondescript kind of. And are they hairy or scaly or just?
They're too small to see.
Okay.
You need a microscope to see what the heck they are. But they fly and they're brown and they come in like ants to honey.
Well, based on their size alone and the fact that they're flying and they're attracted to lights, I would guess that they would be either gnats or midges. In fact, there's a whole family called the Ceratopogonidae. They're called punkies, or their other common name is noceums because they're so small.
I didn't know that.
They're noceum or Ceratopogonid?
Noceum. I'll take that.
Yeah. So just like it sounds, noceum.
Okay.
And they're small enough, actually, to get through a window screen.
Yeah, this is amazing. And what do we do for them without killing the cats?
Oh, well, some Ceratopogonids, not around here so much, are actually nasty biters. Others are pretty innocuous. The problem is you can't really screen them out because they're so small.
What can we do inside? I put some soap down. It probably stopped them a little bit. What can we do, spray them with without killing my cats and wife?
That's what you call Phil Nixon for. He will give you a recommendation on even if you need to spray. So.
And you maybe also you could check with the extension, the U of I extension person who is closest to you. They can advise you too.
What's the spray called?
No. I don't really make recommendations about sprays. But if you want to call Phil Nixon here at 333-6650, that's his job, is to help the public dealing with insect problems.
What about sprays that don't kill cats?
He will help you with that.
He could help you. The thing is that May is not, insect control is really not
my specialty.
Not her specialty.
I'm not really authorized even to.
But Phil could help you, or as I say, if you can figure out who is the extension person who is closest to you, I'm sure that they could help you out.
And make sure you either have. It would really help if you had specimens or photographs.
Yeah, so they know exactly what it is.
Okay, thank you.
Good luck.
Because that's often the problem, and that's the problem that we run in with Phil is here, and when Sandy is here, people have problems, and you really want to tailor your treatment to what it is. So you got to know exactly what it is. And the best thing is if you can catch some of these insects, put them in a bottle so that then you can show them to someone and say, okay, here it is. And then they can figure out, what to do with it. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do here? Line two, and the caller's in Champagne. Hello.
Yeah. Airwicks. Are those old things?
Mm-hmm.
Airwick. Is that correct?
Earwig. Yeah.
I have a crawl space. Do they come up around the pipes, or how do they get in?
Yeah, they like damp places, and especially in basements. And they're recognizable. They're sort of brownish. They have short little forewings, and their hind wings actually fold up under those short covers. And when you unfold them, they actually are kind of ear-shaped, which some people say is why they're called earwigs, although the other explanation is that they crawl into your ears at night and bore into your brain, which is not substantiated by anything. So.
Okay. And I don't have them. They're just once in a while. Mm-hmm. Dampness is when there's...
Yeah, they like damp places.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. And one more. This is someone on the campus, line one. Hello. Is there a caller there on line one? Oh. Yes, go ahead.
I'm in Indiana.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Problem at all.
I
think the cosmic cord test me because I've been wanting to talk to her for some time.
Okay.
Have there been any studies, particularly in butterflies, measuring the amount of dynes used in their performance when they fly? I'm still just, you know, sorry I didn't get into entomology a long time ago. Cause I just sit on my balcony and I watch those skippers do some of the strangest things in the air that, you know, I just try to put it together and, you know, what's going on there. And I know with the electronic stuff, as small as it is, I thought there might be somebody who's doing those kinds of studies.
Well, there are actually. There's a group in England and a group in the U.S., and not so much skippers and not so much butterflies, but hawk moths. Hawk moths are extraordinarily good flyers.
Yeah.
They can even hover, and some can fly backwards, just like hummingbirds.
I've seen those. Yeah, right, yeah. Is this something that I could just get online and put in?
I think if you have any trouble finding it, you can email me and I can get give you some references on that. So.
Okay, you're at the University of Illinois.
Yeah, and maybe my first five letters MAYBE at UIUC.edu.
Okay, we'll give that a try.
Yeah, and it's the fast acrobatic flyers that have attracted the bioengineers.
Okay. Yeah, I can understand. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Well, we're pretty much at the point we have to finish up. I hesitate to sort of launch into something else for that we really won't have time. But I guess it would be worth, again, a plug for people. We sort of missed – if you had been here for Pollinator Week, we would have talked lots and lots about that. But, again, maybe give it a plug for the bee spotter thing that you're trying to get together.
Yeah, so we have a website, and if you're interested in bees and you would like to know anything about them, there's a page on colony collapse disorder. There's a page on how to plant a bee-friendly garden. And then if you actually want to participate in citizen science and help us find out what's going on with the bees, because really what we need is information, you just get out your digital camera and your laptop computer and send photographs of bees or creatures you expect or you believe are bees.
You think might be bees.
And send them in. You can register and become an official bee spotter. And we'd really, really appreciate it because there are just actually not enough bee experts to go around. There's 4,000 species of bees in the U.S. and the number of bee experts is dwindling. So we really need the help from the public on this.
Yeah, and it's we've talked about this, that there's a lot of attention on the European honeybee because it affects by the colony collapse disorder. But there are many, many native species of bees, and I think as you've explained before, we really don't know that much about what's going on with the native bees. They could be having big problems. We could even not know it.
Yeah, bumblebees are fairly large and charismatic, and there are people who are paying attention to them. But there are many, many other very small and very not very flashy bees that are essential to pollinating all kinds of our native wildflowers.
Our guest, May Barenbaum, is head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. Thanks.
Always a pleasure.